So we're talking about echo chambers and political bubbles in this hour. Who builds them? Where do they come from? I mean, take the Koch brothers, the billionaire founders of a right-wing empire. One historian went looking for the origin of their ideas in the archives of a Nobel Prize-winning economist, James Buchanan.
It was called, actually, Buchanan House. And this was actually a working office that had just been essentially deserted. He was 93 when he died in 2013, and there were papers stacked everywhere, including a pile helter-skelter on a chair, and there were filing cabinets everywhere. So I made my way through all the papers on the first level, and when I got to his personal office, there was even more chaos. Catching my breath, I started to dig in, and in that pile, I found documents that exposed essentially a collaboration between the billionaire right-wing donor Charles Koch, members of the George Mason Economics Department, and the university administration to set up an academic base camp, really, for this Charles Koch project. There were many times when I had to remind myself to keep breathing. I just could not believe what I was finding.
The billionaire Koch brothers wield enormous influence in Republican politics. Over the past decade or so, they've pushed their libertarian ideas into the mainstream by funding political campaigns and also by founding a whole slew of libertarian think tanks, political groups, even college programs. Today, Republican politicians cross the Koch brothers at their peril. Well, Duke University historian Nancy McLean wanted to know more about the Koch brothers' political agenda and how did they develop their ideas? Who influenced them? It took a lot of digging. The Kochs are famously secretive, and McLean says most people don't realize just how radical and disruptive their ideas are. In her new book, Democracy in Chains, she traces them back to a Nobel Prize-winning economist named James Buchanan. Steve Paulson's reaction, who?
Well, first of all, he had called since the 1970s for constitutional revolution and advised people on his side that if they wanted to radically change the outcomes of public policy, if they wanted to radically change the society and its institutions, they should focus on changing the rules, not the rulers. He said repeatedly, don't focus on who rules, but on the rules.
So what does that mean? Like what kinds of
rules? Okay, so it included things like the most radical gerrymander we've ever seen in American history to misrepresent the will of the electorate and to overrepresent these extreme Republicans despite what the voters wanted. We saw efforts to undermine collective power. This was a longstanding preoccupation of his, particularly undermine labor unions, particularly public sector unions. This is a man who said at one point that public sector employees should not have the right to vote. They promote private education over public, so shifting tax revenues into private schools.
So basically you're saying, obviously, an attack on the public sector, but even more than that, get rid of government regulations, sort of across the board.
Yes, his case was against government. So he was actually concerned, as he later said in a documentary, to tear down, that is his phrasing, to tear down the idea of the public interest. And he believed he was exposing all public actors as individuals seeking their own personal self-interest and hiding behind a kind of veil of the common good or the
collective.
And
that was his big theory, right? I mean, this is sort of what he won the Nobel Prize for was that people may say they're doing things for the public good, but in fact, everyone is just working for their own self-interest, and let's just be upfront about that, and let's get rid of this illusion of working for the public interest.
Right. So undermine collective organizations, most obviously labor unions, and any group that allows people to come together and make claims on government for the use of tax revenues or government powers.
So you're describing what this one professor, James Buchanan, was talking about, you know, this intellectual who has sort of had this vision of how he thought things were and what should be done. But often intellectuals don't have much power.
Right.
I mean, they don't have much influence. How did he connect with the Koch brothers, in particular with Charles Koch, who, of course, I mean, we all know, I mean, they are famous or infamous in political circles, hated by progressives for their attacks on unions and government regulations and all that. They are, of course, also courted by Republican lawmakers because they give out tens of millions of dollars. So what was the connection between the Koch brothers and Buchanan?
I think I have to back up a little, though, and say from the very beginning, Buchanan was thinking about a long-term kind of multi-decade project to change our politics, to change the way people thought. It was in the 1990s that they really set to work in earnest, and Charles Koch gave his first $10 million contribution to Buchanan Center at George Mason in 1997, saying in the speech that accompanied the gift, "I want to unleash the kind of force that propelled Columbus to his discoveries."
Now, it's worth pointing out that Buchanan was actually a libertarian, so which is somewhat different than the traditional sort of conservative agenda of the Republican Party, and probably different than what Ronald Reagan talked about.
Well, this is really an interesting thing that you're raising here, because this cause now sails under the banner of conservatism, but in its earlier years, when it was more honest, it did not. So Buchanan specifically disavowed the label conservative. Charles Koch, when he was funding all these libertarian organizations in the early years of the 1970s, insisted that they remain pure in their radicalism, that they never compromise. You know, they made fun of conservatives. But when they became serious about really changing our institutions and our Constitution, they realized libertarians are only 3-4% of the electorate at best. They needed larger numbers, and so they made these marriages of convenience with other partners who did have the votes.
They just wanted to get government out of the business of regulating people's lives, right?
Period.
I mean, that was,
yes.
I mean, that is the essence of being a libertarian.
Right. But the dogma also has terrible implications for the rest of us. So, for example, the Koch donor network is now funding all kinds of efforts at climate science misinformation and actually trying to defame individual climate scientists using Buchanan-like ideas. So, just to give you a sense of the impact that that push has had, in 1991, before this all got going, there was no discernible difference between Democrats and Republicans in Congress on their understanding of the fact that climate change is man-made. No difference. You know, they might disagree about the policies to deal with it, but no difference on the basic assessment. By 2014, only 8 of 278 Republican members of Congress would admit that climate change was man-made. I really do believe that this ideology and this set of institutions poses an imminent threat to all of us.
Nancy, your book, Democracy in Chains, has generated quite a lot of buzz and controversy. And I should mention that we're talking right after the book was just named a finalist for the National Book Award. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You've gotten rave reviews. You've also been attacked by people who say you've distorted the evidence to make your argument, that you have concocted a conspiracy theory to explain the rise of right-wing politics in America, that you've claimed to have uncovered the secret plan to destroy American democracy, which your critics say is way overblown. How do you respond to the criticism?
Well, I think I would start with what you said, that most of the people who are coming to this with an independent mind and reading the whole book are persuaded that it's a really convincing case. Within, I'd say, maybe about 3 weeks or so after the book was published, I started getting attacked very aggressively from the right, saying the kinds of things that you've said and more. The interesting thing is I had predicted it in the book, but because they attack anyone who exposes them. So the journalist Jane Mayer found that they had hired private investigators to try to dig up dirt on her.
She wrote the book.
I'm sorry, Dark Money.
On the
Trail of the Money. And the climate scientists, you know, I mentioned before, have been dogged personally by this cause.
So I want to pick up one thread of what you've said, which is that this was a stealth campaign, that Buchanan tried to keep his political activities secret because he thought that if people actually knew what he was talking about, you know, he'd have no support, basically. Why did he consider secrecy so important?
Well, I think he did understand from early on that these ideas were unpopular. In the early 1970s, when he was beginning to bring people together to strategize for creating a conservative counterintelligentsia, as he called it, he said in one document, conspiratorial secrecy is at all times essential. The Tea Party was a great boon to this cause. They didn't create it initially, but then they fed it and encouraged it and so forth. And two distinguished researchers, Theda Skocpol at Harvard and Vanessa Williams, went out and did the most systematic study that we have of Tea Party chapters around the country. They could not find a single rank-and-file Tea Party activist or grassroots leader who wanted to see the privatization of Social Security and Medicare. But that is what these Koch operations are using these Tea Party groups to do as a kind of battering ram to soften the terrain so that they can ultimately privatize Social Security and Medicare. So there's
so you're saying, for instance, they are pushing for privatizing Social Security and Medicare, but they will never actually say that.
Exactly. They will say they are reforming it. And I actually describe in the book, too, Buchanan was crucial in this as well. In 1983— Charles Koch's Cato Institute made the privatization of Social Security its top priority, but Buchanan knew, and he advised them in print, that there was no support in the public for this. And he actually goes through all the demographics, neither black nor white nor rich or poor or male or female or Sunbelt or Frostbelt. Nobody supported these radical changes to Social Security. Instead of saying what a normal person would have said, oh, okay, it's a popular program, it works, let's leave it be. He said, no, if you want to undermine it, here's how you do it. And he went on to lay out a kind of 5-point strategy for how to do that, which was ultimately a stealth strategy.
So if James Buchanan looked at this and saw that there was all this popular support for Social Security, why would he think that it should be abolished?
Ideologically, it was offensive to him as a libertarian, as it is to Charles Koch and to others in that cause. In a libertarian's view of what the government should do, there are only three things. It can ensure the national defense, enforce the rule of law, and guarantee social order. Just those three things. Anything more than that is unacceptable to them and illegitimate. So that's why I think this cause is so frightening and so radical, because basically it is taking aim at the entire model of 20th century citizen-driven government. So many Republicans have been disciplined by this cause that has basically turned one of our major political parties into a Leninist libertarian party. I don't use that phrase lightly, but Charles Koch and one of the people he funded in the 1970s were reading Lenin to think about how a minority could affect a radical transformation. And they have built this Leninist-style discipline into the Republican Party where people are afraid not to toe the line.
Historian Nancy MacLean talking with Steve Paulson. Her book is called Democracy in Chains.